Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today marked the official opening of the long-awaited Bob Dylan Center in the Tulsa Arts District. This 29,000-square-foot exhibition space is filled with Bob Dylan memorabilia, ephemeral, lots of music, and multimedia interactive exhibits. But the true story of the center is a larger story of one man's creative process and artistic growth. A key feature of the center's exhibits focuses on how a songwriter like Dylan creates a song, the writing, rewriting, and honing of a lyric. The center features 6 in-depth modules that will investigate a song's genesis. These will be rotating exhibits working their way through Dylan's incredibly large catalog. There's also an audio studio where visitors can hear tracks as they were created, as well as copious audio areas and an immersive video experience featuring concert performances, many of which were unreleased. Joining me today is the center's director, Stephen Jenkins. The center opened this morning at 10 a.m. and will be open in future weeks, Wednesday through Sunday, at their facility at 116 East Reconciliation Way. Stephen Jenkins is my guest today to talk about the new Bob Dylan Center here on Studio Tulsa. Stephen Jenkins, welcome to Studio Tulsa, and congratulations on a great opening weekend leading into the opening of the Bob Dylan Center as it opens today.
Thank you so much, Rich.
You know, most museums about an entertainer or performing artist often focus on the ephemera, if you will, the Smithsonian approach. You know, here's Dorothy's red slippers, you know, that sort of thing. And there's certainly plenty of ephemera at the center, but it seems like the Bob Dylan Center really is trying to look at artistic process. What are the goals of the center as far as the public face of the center?
Well, it's 2, if not 3, or multi-tiered. So I'll point out a couple of things that we really hope to keep at the forefront of our intentions. You know, whether or not visitors pick up on all these strands remains to be seen as we're now opening our doors. But first and foremost, this is, of course, a celebration of the life, work, career, astonishing accomplishments of one Bob Dylan, who I believe stands alone within American music and American culture for the longevity of his work, for his impact, not just nationally, but certainly globally, on music, so many idioms that he's explored, the wordplay that he's brought to songcraft, the magnificent melding of lyric and melody and rhythm and performance, as well as his other forms of artistry, perhaps somewhat lesser known, but quite accomplished. Bob Dylan spends much of his time painting. Dylan works with metal and creates these fantastic sculptural gates, one of which you will see as a visitor when you enter the main entrance on 116 East Reconciliation Way in Tulsa's Arts District. And you'll see a metalwork made by Dylan. We wanted to surprise people right away by showing them something made by the man that isn't musical. The rest of the center, of course, focuses primarily on his music. And we were looking at all of this material, this trove of handwritten manuscripts, photographs, film clips, recordings, of course, instruments, memorabilia, if you will, though with a caveat that we're trying to make the pieces more than just, say, the tambourine that inspired Mr. Tambourine Man. It's wonderful to see that tambourine, but what we want to do is tell a story around it. What was happening in Dylan's creative process at the time that might have provided an impetus to look at that tambourine as the source for a song, one of his enduring classics. So we're presenting this material. We're celebrating Dylan. We're investigating. We're doing that rigorously, as any center or museum should, particularly one that is stewarding an archive. But we're really doing this with an eye on accessibility as well. And we're looking at Dylan as an exemplar of creativity. Creativity unfettered, fearless. This is someone who has just pursued, whether or not he refers to it as a muse, I don't know, but who has just been tireless and fearless in pursuing his own vision. And if visitors come in and they see that here's someone who, like, you know, any artist, even though he seems to operate in some lofty realm, well, sure, there's some alchemical genius that does seem to occur with Dylan often. But more often than not, he is writing and rewriting and crossing out lyrics. We have notebooks and manuscripts that show the struggle, the fact that a song has him in its grip and, you know, isn't letting go, or he isn't letting go of it. Until he gets it just right, we have, say, 40 pages of lyrics for the song Dignity, rewriting and writing. Funnily enough, a song that obviously he grappled with for so long, and then it didn't make the cut when he was putting together the final track list, in that case for the album Oh Mercy. We have multiple versions of lyrics for something like Tangled Up in Blue,
right,
or Simple Twist of Fate. And what you see here, you know, and these are some of the most beloved songs in his canon, and I would argue of American music of the last 50, 60 years, you see someone grappling with how to do this the best possible way. We have recordings of Dylan in the studio trying to figure out how to lay down a track. The song Most of the Time from Oh Mercy, such a beautiful song, so perfectly, exquisitely written and arranged. And you can now hear earlier versions where there's sort of an extra chord in there that he's tripping over, or the cadence isn't working for him. And so in all these ways, and we can go deep into examples like that, I hope that visitors get a sense of, you know, this takes work. I mean, that it sounds obvious, but somehow with Dylan, I think we discount all that he puts into making the work and the songs as great as they are.
And really, that's the process of any artist as well.
Correct.
And, you know, when you're talking about, you know, having notebooks, it's one thing to see it that way. But when you also have his recording archive as well,
yes,
you can hear and read it as well. Because a lot of the process, if you just had the notebooks, it wouldn't tell the full story.
I think that's true.
And if you just had the recording, it wouldn't tell the full story as well. And I assume one of the goals of the center is to meld the technology to make it easy for a visitor to see that process through the notebooks, through the recording sessions, and the trial and error of a recording session as it exists, to help us understand how we get to the finished product.
Exactly. We're really trying to make that journey visible and compelling. You know, because when you have an archive, often you have sheafs of papers, and, you know, which can be fascinating on one level, but what you want to make sure, I believe, if we're doing our job right anyway at the center, is we're bringing those materials to life, and we're making them vital, and we're imbuing them through the right sort of exhibition and display strategies, imbuing them with a life and a relevance to all visitors who come in. So, for example, whether you're on a touch screen that we have throughout the displays and you can, with your fingertips, swipe, we're all spending our lives swiping right and left on screens, but these bring you into successive writings of a song like Joker Man. For me, one of Dylan's most fascinating songs. We could spend all day talking about who is the figure of this Joker Man and how it might seem to change from verse to verse and stanza to stanza. So Joker Man was another one of these. It kicks off the 1983 album Infidels, and Dylan really worked at it. And so you can see how specific phrases in the songs, again, on a touchscreen that's illustrated that you as a visitor can activate, how the particular words and phrases were changing. He was trying things. You know, maybe they just weren't singing the right way. Maybe the metaphor wasn't the right one. There were biblical allusions, you know, reference to the book of Leviticus and Deuteronomy. Well, those weren't in there from the first version. And each one changes the meaning of the verse, which ultimately changes the meaning of the song. So I think people have a lot of fun as they come into the center going through that kind of layering and building up and revising of a single lyric over time. We have a church studio control room, essentially a recording studio, in which visitors can play producer and engineer. If you want to hear Al Kooper's incredible Hanging On For Dear Life organ track,
right,
on Like a Rolling Stone, a young guy who sat down, by many accounts, having never played the organ before.
He became an organist on this session. Right?
As the song was unspooling over 6 minutes. And, you know, it's one of the great musical tracks that we have. And you can turn dials and push levers and isolate that track. They're called stems. Yeah. So we've separated out all of these recordings into their various stems. You can pull up Dylan's vocals, and you can really get into the grit, the grain, the, you know, at times raspiness, at times it's much clearer. Thinking about what is he emphasizing and why? You know, make a deal, make a steal, whatever the word is. I will spare you my Dylan impersonation. You know, we all sing along in our own way. But It's what draws you back to those songs again and again, not just the multiplicity of meanings that you can draw from them, but the astonishing performances of them in the studio. And with this experience at the Dylan Center, you can really, I think, gain a deeper understanding for what was going on with those producers and those musicians right there in the space. To me, it's very exciting.
My guest today is Steve Jenkins, the director of the Bob Dylan Center. The Bob Dylan Center opened today in the Tulsa Arts District, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. And I would assume when you have those recording sessions, and I know with the recording archives, when you delve into it, you begin to see the collaborative process as well, because you have a producer who's hearing things and saying, this is a little clunky here. How do we fix this?
Sure thing.
You know, and Dylan and the producer, the other musicians are probably making suggestions as well.
They are, and you're hearing it as it's going down, because again, as we started to pour through the archives once they were acquired in 2016 here in Tulsa, you know, this embarrassment of riches, if you will, just this unimaginable, still to us, trove of materials. Many items long whispered about in hallowed terms by Dylanologists the world over. You know, we think there are these notebooks that Dylan kept in 74 and 75, the early versions, early lyrics of songs that ended up on Blood on the Tracks, songs like Tangled Up in Blue and Simple Twist of Fate. So there have been rumors of these notebooks. One turned up in the collection of the Morgan Library in New York. But no, that's not enough. There was still talk. No, there's got to be a couple more, because what that one notebook showed were very early iterations of the songs. And it was imagined that there had to have been a bridge between the earliest lyrics and what we know is the final on the Blood on the Tracks album. Sure enough, two other notebooks emerged in the boxes as they were lids were taken off and gone through by our director and curator of the Bob Dylan Archives, Dr. Mark Davidson, and he discovered these two other notebooks. We now have, thanks to the Morgan Library, who loaned us that first one, the trio of what we call the Blood notebooks. Mm-hmm. And this is, you know, in a way, the holy grail of Dylan studies for a lot of folks who have spent quite a bit of their lives, you know, chasing down every possible clue to Dylan's process. And we've got the notebooks on view.
Yeah. What about earlier periods? Did he work more ephemerally? I know at some point, you know, artists often will jot down lyrics on a cocktail napkin, you know, or on a matchbook cover. And I believe there are examples of that.
Matchbook covers, we have a lot of hotel stationery.
Yeah.
Suggesting someone who, you know, a Dylan who played a show. And who knows whether he was out on the town for a while, but somehow ended up back in his hotel room late at night, inspiration or whatever it might be, whatever you might want to call it, strikes. And he's reaching for the stationery on the nightstand around the desk in a hotel room somewhere in Topeka or somewhere in, any town. He was touring frantically then and continues, as we know, you know, it's referred to as Dylan's never-ending tour, because COVID aside, which slowed all of us down, and, you know, Dylan amongst the rest of us, so he didn't play for a couple of years, but he's out back at it. Yeah. This is a man in his early 80s. I defy a band, you know, or a singer-songwriter half his age to keep up this pace and to play the quality of show that he does. So he's still out there and probably still riding on the road and keeping his own particular practice alive by jotting things down as they come to him.
Well, that brings up a good question. You know, the Kaiser Family Foundation bought this archive. Will there be additional deliveries upon, you know, the end of his career, the end of his life?
Which we hope we cannot see that date in the future. Let this go on forever and ever. But sure, you know, but it's appropriate. Of course, the archive goes up to just about 2016, which was when the Kaiser Foundation acquired them, and when the American Song Archives, which is our overarching umbrella organization, took on the stewardship. I think it's worth pointing out the American Song Archives operates not only the newly opened Bob Dylan Center, but the Woody Guthrie Center, which has established itself, I think, as a can't-miss attraction in Tulsa for the past 8 years. But of course, Dylan hasn't stopped, nor do we hope he ever does. We will, as always, be chasing after him, you know, literally and figuratively, to figure him out to whatever extent we might want to or can, to grapple with his meanings and his potentials and his power. And so, yes, we will continue to amass materials for the archive. I can say, you know, the phone has been ringing and people will say, listen, you know, my uncle had always held on to a snapshot that he took of Bob when they happened to meet along the way somewhere. Is that something you might be interested in looking at? Or, you know, I have a ticket stub from one of the first shows at Town Hall in New York. In 1963. And we'll, you know, we're thrilled to talk to folks and really we'll assess those opportunities on a case-by-case basis, because the main thing is, does this add to an overall knowledge of an appreciation of Dylan? Or perhaps this is a keepsake that the person who has this treasure in hand, it means more to that person to hang on to. You know, maybe this is something you want to hand down in the family. But look, please show us what you have, because if it helps us tell a bigger story and we can be relatively well assured that it's something we can display at some point or make available to scholars at some point, then of course we'd love to add to the collection.
Let's talk about the work of scholarship, which is, you know, Dylan, for a contemporary American performing artist, pop performing artist, if you will, has had probably far more scholarship than your average performer.
Absolutely. There are shelves and shelves of, you know, each book fascinating in its own way.
So what is the balance between, again, showcasing an artist's work and career and the scholarship to understand their motivations and process and, you know, their artistic growth?
Sure. I believe the center will be unique in that we really can do both in a very thorough fashion. So to give you a sense of it, our the center is about 29,000 square feet, so we have a lot of room to roam and spread out. Over half of that total space is given over to public exhibition space, which is very key to us. This is about access and being inclusive and not exclusive, so the center is open to all. We have two floors overflowing, though in an artful way, in a careful, you know, curatorial aesthetic way, with materials that folks can, you know, I can imagine someone, you know, wandering through for an hour or so and someone else who will spend all day or days, depending on how deep one might want to go. A whole other section of the center, however, is given over to the archive materials themselves and to a library-like setting where scholars and academics will come, accredited, vetted by Mark Davidson, again, our director and curator of the Bob Dylan Archive. If they're working on a dissertation, if they're working on a book, an article, a series, whatever it might be, and the materials that we're fortunate enough to have on hand are valuable to them in their research, of course, it's in our interest and in theirs and in the field's interest to make these materials available. So put on your white gloves, handle these materials, let them seep in and glean their meanings to whatever extent they can for you and your academic scholarly, you know, or mainstream publication might benefit from.
My guest today is Stephen Jenkins, the director of the Bob Dylan Center, which opened today in the Tulsa Arts District, long awaited. I think ever since the announcement, you know, we had a slight taste at Gilcrease Museum, just
yes.
the briefest.
Of, a tease.
Yeah, an appetizer.
Yes.
But the real deal exhibition is open now today. And you're using technology throughout the museum, you know, a great way to experience Bob Dylan performances with a theater, sort of a setting where you're able to watch performances. You have touch screen access to a lot of materials. Talk a little about how you meld technology with the materials.
Absolutely. We wanted to get the smartest people in the room on this to really do justice to the material and not merely to just have bells and whistles, but to serve the material, to, again, bring the archive to life. So what visitors will find when they come to the first main gallery space, we have what we're calling the immersive film experience. This is put together by a documentary filmmaker, Jennifer LeBeau, who has done some wonderful work on Dylan in the past. She's focused, for example, on the so-called Born Again years, where Dylan, perhaps his most shocking move at all, was in a way his most mainstream, espousing a, you know,
right,
a Christianity.
You got to serve somebody. That's why that song
You got to serve somebody, yeah. You know, and that, I think it was such a shocker, just to go off on a brief side. It was so shocking to hear Dylan The guy who would always sidestep pigeonholing or an attempt at someone to define who or what he was. You know, protest singer, I'm not a protest singer. Voice of a generation, what are you talking about? I'm talking just for me. I don't know what generation you're talking about. Well, here he, you know, suddenly for a few years was espousing, a widely practiced belief system. And I'm happy that we can now really look back at the music that was made during that period, I hope with fresh ears, and realize how wonderful this gospel-infused music was. But yes, we're doing this. So that's Jen LeBeau. She made that earlier film. She has now risen to a different sort of challenge, which is not just put together a documentary where you're sitting in a seat and you're looking at a single screen. I mean, that's a wonderful presentation for all sorts of things. But we wanted to put the viewer within a setting. So you find yourself in a gallery that becomes Greenwich Village in 1963 or becomes on stage during the Rolling Thunder Review tour of the mid-70s, where Dylan was picking up musicians in every city the bus was rolling through and coming up with just this wonderfully ragtag assembly of accompanists. Through multiple screens, overlays, projections, audio and visuals working in tandem with one another, you're really surrounded by the Dylan sensibility. So you can soak up that atmosphere and that environment before moving into other gallery settings where, again, you have interactive elements that rely on the latest technology that we have at our disposal to enliven the viewer's experience. You become participatory in telling the Dylan story. And adding your own perspective to it. You know, there's no one way to traverse the gallery settings. Start on the second floor if you'd like, or ignore chronology altogether, as we have through the wonderful essayist and Dylan scholar Sean Wilentz. On the perimeter walls of the interior gallery on the first floor, he's broken up Dylan's life and work into nine key eras. But there's no saying that you must start with the earliest one and work your way up to the latest. Go in reverse order. Any and all approaches somehow, I believe, make sense when you're grappling with the Dylan story or stories, always a plurality.
Let's talk about the permanent galleries, but it sounds like you have also created this in a way like the Sean Wilentz, you know, noted historian,
yes,
comes up with these nine periods. Will you have the flexibility to sort of reimagine part of the gallery space and take in new views, different viewpoints from scholars?
Very much so. That's a big part of what we want to do. We don't want things to stay still for too long. So, for example, visitors will come in to a major gallery space on the first floor, and they'll see quadrants of display area around which we have arranged information and materials that pertain to the writing, recording, producing, performance, and second, third, and consecutive lives of six key Dylan songs. Now, right away, I know what you're thinking. What are these six, and are they among my favorites? Maybe we've hit one or two, but, you know, everyone's got their own. We started with six that we feel represent key moments in Dylan's creative development.
Across the arc.
Yes, you can look at something like Chimes of Freedom, where even then, you know, Dylan was looking at an Irish melody from, you know, decades before and sort of appropriating, if you will. And that's a whole other discussion about what musicians do and how they take and look at and listen to the work that's come before them. So you see how Chimes of Freedom developed from its wonderful sing-song melody, you know, but paired with words that were really a kind of battle cry for the moment, the civil rights movement. You can then get into something from decades later. 1997's Not Dark Yet, I think, is worth pointing out. This is a central song on Dylan's incredible record, Time Out of Mind, which, you know, for whatever awards mean, won Grammy Award for Album of the Year, shockingly something that had never come Dylan's way before. And with Not Dark Yet, this ruminative, plaintive, achingly resigned yet, you know, passionate song. And you get into how that was written and recorded and the response that folks had to that song. Another interesting one for me, I think, is The Man in Me. This was what you might call a deep album cut from New Morning from the very early 70s. There were other songs that were garnering more attention around that time, something maybe like Lay Lady Lay. But The Man in Me, you know, just a quiet favorite of some. But then found a whole new audience when T-Bone Burnett selected it for the soundtrack to The Big Lebowski.
Right.
T-Bone has a knack for picking just the right assortment of unexpected songs, particularly working with the Coen brothers, and in that case for the Big Lebowski doing it again, and finding a different context. And suddenly The Man in Me, I think for a while, was the most downloaded Dylan song on a streaming site. So, you know, we're looking at those things. So you have the dude abiding the great Jeff Bridges, you know, to the accompaniment of Dylan's song that was originally written and recorded decades earlier. Oh. But those songs, and there were three others, and I'll let visitors and listeners come in and discover those for themselves. They, you know, give us another 6 months and we'll have six more stories to tell about another half dozen songs. So that's an example of how we will keep the display and exhibition rotating. On the second floor, we have the Parker Brothers Creators Gallery. This is where we will really introduce and give a good amount of gallery space over to the work of other artists or creators, if you will. We're starting with the work of the wonderful photographer and filmmaker Jerry Schatzberg. Schatzberg's image of Dylan, a portrait called Edenic Innocence, graces the facade of our building in a giant mural that was spray painted on by a wonderful artist named Eric Burke. So we thought how appropriate to not only adorn our building with a Schatzberg image of Dylan, but to flesh out Schatzberg with a retrospective of his work from the 60s. So we have more images of Dylan. They had a wonderful rapport in the photography studio. We even have the props that Dylan is holding in some of those photographs in vitrines within the gallery. But Schatzberg did this incredible series of portraits with folks like Faye Dunaway, who he happened to be involved with romantically at the time, with Jimi Hendrix caught looking into a mirror, seemingly unaware of the camera, the Beatles at Shea Stadium, the Rolling Stones in drag, all sorts of wonderful, just alive photos that I think visitors will really be wowed by. And another few months, we'll be able to show the work of another creator, whether another photographer, a video artist, a choreographer, any art form you can imagine. We're working very closely, for example, with Joy Harjo, who I hope is familiar to listeners yes. as a Tulsan through and through, just wrapping up her third term as U.S. Poet Laureate, an incredible honor, but fitting for someone of Joy's gifts. Joy is also a very accomplished musician who plays a mean saxophone. And Joy is our first artist in residence. And so there, with Joy, we have someone who's seeing Dylan through her own perspective. And we'll be working with her, for example, to bring in Native American musicians to do concerts. Maybe we'll all be out at Guthrie Green, you know, inviting the whole town down for a Saturday afternoon concert. So we really are committed to, yes, focusing on Dylan, but adding to that dialogue with the work of other artists and creators.
The creative process.
Absolutely.
Stephen Jenkins is the director of the Bob Dylan Center. The center opened this morning at 10 a.m. and will be open this week, today through Sunday. Normal hours will be Wednesday through Sunday at their facility at 116 East Reconciliation Way, just across from Guthrie Green. For more information and tickets, visit bobdylancenter.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Greger. We're going to leave you with the music of Dylan. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening. Storm clouds are raging all around my door. I think to myself I might not take it anymore. Take a woman like your kind to find the man in me. But oh, just to know that you are near.